This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the show, New Books Network. Jose Luis Torres. Great pleasure to have you here. And you were born in Puerto Rico and raised in the South Bronx. And you live at present, I believe, in New York. And you have been teaching American literature and U.S. ethnic literatures at the State University of New York campus. Now, let's talk about your book a little. Your writing comes from a wellspring of insight about the Puerto Rican experience. Tell us a little about yourself, your childhood, and your life thus far.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast, Minnie. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I was born in Puerto Rico. My mother came to the U.S. And took me and my half-brother when I was just 5 years old. And I pretty much grew up in New York City, in the South Bronx specifically, all my formative years, pretty much. And I went to school there, had all my formal education there, from undergraduate all the way to my doctorate. I returned to Puerto Rico right after I got my MFA from Columbia University, because I wanted to go to Puerto Rico and get some material for my writing. That's basically the reason why. And I ended up staying there for a long period. I didn't think I was going to. I thought I was just going to go return and come back. My mother had just recently moved there, and I wanted to help her also sort of acclimate back to the island. And I found a job teaching there, and I realized that teaching was really something I wanted to do. So that's what I ended up doing. I ended up teaching, and then I got married in at the same time that I was doing my doctorate. Doctorate is something I do not recommend to anyone, to get married at the same time that they are doing a doctorate. But that's what happened. And so the rest of it was just basically teaching on the areas that you mentioned. But also, I've always been a creative writer, so I've always been able to write fictional work and poetry and get it published.
Each of your stories, which in the book Migrations, condenses a bit of the experience of a cross-section of Puerto Rico, the rich who treat it like a playground, the stereotypical macho men, the shantytown dwellers, and the ramifications of your stories are deep. You touch on topics like climate change and how tourists and travel agents destroy natural ecosystems. You also delve into a bit of history of Puerto Ricans going to boarding school in the United States in the early part of the century, something like the Indian students in Canada whose mass graves were recently discovered and their suffering there. And you have put a lot of facts out in the open that are otherwise forgotten by those who think of Puerto Rico as blessed because it's a colony of the United States. Do you see your work as a kind of censure of mainstream America?
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. And I think, you know, my writing is in the same vein as other multi-ethnic writers in the U.S. who we've got a voice, you know, once we got a voice and we're able to publish our work and actually write, we want to tell our stories. And our stories are easily very much in opposition to the mainstream world, right? Because as most nation states, the U.S. is no different. We're not exceptional, really, in any particular way. In that regard, we bury the truth. And the truth is that many times the U.S. has done horrific things to its people, and people that they didn't, you know, the mainstream, you know, white folks, basically European Americans, didn't even consider people. So, you know, we're a colonized people, and as a colonized people, the U.S., you know, we have been suffering under that. We're sort of citizens, but we're not. This is, if anything, also we could probably describe this as a neo-colony, because this is a different type of colony, invented sort of in the late 19th century, early 20th. They gave us citizenship 1917, pretty much just to use our people, our men in particular, to go off to war. That was everything. That's pretty much established. And sometimes I wonder if some people in the U.S. feel it was a mistake to do that, like our recent president, who actually said, "Can we take citizenship back from these people?" And he actually wanted to trade us, you know, with Denmark for Greenland. I mean, this is the type of attitude. It seems crazy, but you know, there are a lot of people that feel the same way. And so when I write to counter those kinds of narratives, to show what has happened with our people in regards to being a colonial, colony of the United States. And you talk about colony to people in the U.S. What do you mean colony? Like that's an old-fashioned word, but it's not. You know, the United States is an empire like any other empire. I mean, India knows about colonization. And one of the things that's always amazed me about that is a country so big, and yet it was dominated by a country smaller. And for many, many years, as you know. And so we're a small nation. And now, you know, pretty much empowered, you know, taken over by such an incredible power that militarily and has his own empire, right? So, I think it's essential, because I think that history, which is really our history, I'm just presenting our part of our history. And our history obviously has been connected to the U.S., so whatever has happened to us is a direct, you know, connection to the U.S. You know, who sent us these young people to these Indian schools? It was Americans when they took over the island, thinking that they somehow, these are also Indians. And I was wondering, when I was used that word, I'm not talking to an Indian from India, you know, I always wonder how weird that name is for native people of, you know, the Americas, right? And we all know why it was always, you know, Columbus just, you know, thought he was in India. And so these indigenous folks in Puerto Rico, we did have Taino Indians, and they thought that these were another type of Indians. They just sent them to the school to, you know, assimilate them and sort of make them into civilized, quote unquote, civilized people. So yeah, it's been my writing definitely is a censure. I like to call, I think it's a contestatory literature. It's contesting the narrative, and it's also in many ways post-colonial, although I use that word carefully because we're still a colony. But it's sort of in the post-colonial vein, kind of looking back at that relationship and sort of looking at it critically and analytically.
My next question is about some of the stories in your book. A couple of stories in the book are about the Puerto Ricans of the diaspora who struggle in dysfunctional families, who long to be part of the mainstream, but have weathered the subtle racism of American society, and this has taken a toll on their inner lives. Your stories bring alive Puerto Rico to us, its natural beauty and people. Others are based in the South Bronx. Have you tried to de-essentialize Puerto Rico in some way, reveal to us a materialist history, so to speak, and show the colonial economy that the country really is? Like you said in your earlier, what you said earlier as well, was that you want to reveal the true side of Puerto Rico. So could you tell us a little bit in detail about some of these stories and what moved you to write your favorite stories in this collection?
Well, any time that you really are writing contestatory literature, you know, which a lot of multi-ethnic literature is, you're going to just, by writing what you write, you're going to be contesting, you know, what happened. And in many cases, you also are trying to counter the narratives that have been established by the mainstream writers, right? I mean, I always think of when people think about Puerto Ricans, there's so little about us that whatever is out there is almost always racist and sort of written from a white perspective, right? Like I keep thinking of West Side Story, which was a musical in the U.S. I don't know how growing up how many times people would be singing that song to me in some kind of way, I don't know, awkward way to connect, I don't know, which is, you know, again, in today's parlance, it's a microaggression, you know. Why are you singing me this song, which I personally hate, and really is misrepresenting me in so many different ways? And so, yeah, we have to, I am trying to say, okay, these are the stories that were actually written about us. And I'm not a big fan of these stories because I think if I unpackage them, they're racist and they're not in any way really realistic to me and people like me. So, for instance, there's a story that deals with gangs. You know, West Side Story was about gang members, right? Because that's like, it seems like the only thing they can think about us when they think about Puerto Ricans is that we were all in gangs or something like, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, there were gangs all over the city in the 90s when this story, Rip and Wreck and the Collection is written. But there's also other aspects that I'm trying to get at. First of all, this story is not so much a typical gang story, but it's two young people who have gotten out of that lifestyle after the trauma they face. And I'm trying to also give some kind of credence to their perspective of what that was like, because the story is from their eyes, not from some other person who's white looking at them saying, you're all like sort of savages or animals. These are young people and who have gotten in many ways victimized by a society that is has redlined the neighborhood. You know, there's really no money coming into that neighborhood. The resources are limited there. The educational system that they're facing is oppressive. And so they are, from their perspective, they're surviving and they're trying to, you know, get the American dream. And then what happens is their young son who's gifted. This is another thing too, right? Like I wanted to make this character like brilliant. I wanted to make him a young man who is really, really intelligent, because you know what? The Puerto Ricans are quite brilliant and intelligent. But the sad part of it is because the violence around him is still there. There's vestiges of that gang life still in their parents, because you don't completely get away from it. That creates tension in story. And I don't want to tell, the readers can read for themselves. But this is a man who, you know, finds school boring because it doesn't really excite him. He's not really doing anything with his intelligence and his gift. So, yeah, I'm very much aware of my agenda, as it were, as a writer. I take pride in that. I think that that's why I write. There aren't too many Puerto Rican fiction writers in the U.S. There are many more poets, great poets, but I think there's a void there, because I do believe that ultimately narrative is strong. It has many qualities that I am a poet too. But I love poetry, but I think telling stories, and you can tell stories in poetry too, but you know, real like narrative is strong, and trying to get empathy from people and trying to get them to understand your position. And when it comes to history, I think history becomes more palpable. It becomes more real to people when it's told in a way that, you know, in a fictional way that they can understand it. Rather than if they read a cold sort of historical, you know, just an account of something. So I think I have answered your question. I hope I have answered. Now you can just dig deeper into anything else you might want to include. But I would say, I definitely am trying to deal with those issues.
Mm-hmm. And apart from the marginalized people, you also talk about middle-class Puerto Ricans, some of whom are quite rich and upper class and who come to visit Puerto Rico, and the messier side of Puerto Rican life is also revealed to them, and they get a shock as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think you're probably talking about Nikki, who is Puerto Rican. There's also a divide, isn't it, between Puerto Ricans who live in the States and the ones that live in the island. And Nikki is a completely assimilated a Puerto Rican, and she doesn't want to go back to that. And it's really her husband, who's white, who comes in as a tourist, really. They're married, and I think he also, I think a subtle kind of a thing that I'm saying there is also, here's a guy, a white guy, who has exoticized his wife, you know, who happens to Puerto Rican and Caribbean and you know, hot Latina or whatever. You know, there's something, this a little bit of that. And, you know, she does love him. You know, they actually love each other. But there's that element in that relationship. And she's also younger. So it's almost like she's a trophy wife, that kind of thing. And she doesn't want to go back to the island. But he loves it because it's like a paradise to him. But then you realize that Puerto Rico is far from being a paradise. I mean, there's a lot of issues and problems. Just as I speak, there's problems right now. The electrical grid is just a mess. And Puerto Rico is being run by an American junta. And it's actually called the junta, which whoever came up with that name knows absolutely nothing about Latin American history. You just don't use that word in a Latin American context without like having people shudder, you know? And it's a junta, you know, that's running sort of the economic situation in Puerto Rico because, just defaulted the debt. It's just a real bad situation in Puerto Rico. And I left Puerto Rico in about 2000 to come back to the States because as much as I love the island and really wanted to make change there, I couldn't deal with it. It was really a mess, and I saw it coming. I saw this economy is going to collapse. So, you know, it's a colony that's not being run well. And the U.S. has this sort of benign neglect attitude towards, you know, Puerto Rico. It doesn't want to give it statehood. It doesn't want to give it independence. And it relies on the indecision of a people, colonized people, to you guys decide what you want to do. As if they know that right now it's almost impossible. We're in an impasse. So they rely on that indecision and inertia to just keep us where we're at, which is to their benefit. So, yeah, it's a real, you know, we're like, someone kept saying that we're the oldest colony in the world. And I think that might be true. And it's just crazy to think in the 21st century, you know, country, developed country has these colonies. And we're not the only one, the Virgin Islands, Guam, you know, Marianne Islands, there's others also. So, yeah, I would say, That is the case, certainly, yeah.
Your book reminded me of another novel as well, Eduardo Lalo Simón. So yes,
I'm not familiar. Is he Puerto Rican? No, he's Latino or Latinx.
No, I think he's Puerto. The book is about Puerto Rico.
Okay, is he a island writer? Or does he?
Yes, I think. In Spanish, and then it's translated. Yeah.
And there's a big difference too, because a lot of you know, is what I write Puerto Rican or is it American literature? You know, that's a good question. I myself, you know, I am not going to decide that, but I write exclusively in English, and there might be some parts in Spanish. And there's a big gap, I think, between you know, writers from the island and people, intellectuals from the island. Sometimes I even look at work like mine, or work of U.S. you know, Puerto Ricans in the diaspora, you know, diaspora Rican. And there are others that are more progressively minded who actually think, yeah, that's still part of Puerto Rican literature, but it's written in English. And, you know, a good portion of it. Martin Espada, who's a poet that I really love, he writes in English. Willy Perdomo writes in English. You know, Esmeralda Santiago writes in English. Vega, Edgardo Vega Unque, who I love and I think is, you know, really our best to date, our best novelist, you know, wrote in English. So, you know, are they teaching these schools? And part of the problem too, a lot of this work has not been translated into Spanish. And maybe if they were, maybe it would be easier for our folks back in Puerto Rico to read them. But unless they read English, it's not going to be possible. So in what way do you think is similar, that work, our work? Because now I want to read him, because I do read it in Spanish. I mean, I just
It's as incisive as yours. you know, when you're deconstructing your characters, the exotic trophy wife, etc. Eduardo Lalo also talks in the same terms about these characters. I mean, there's no romanticism of Puerto Rico. In some of the other writers, one does find one a kind of romanticism, that one loses the social critique completely in those works. But yours and Eduardo Lalo's hit me quite strongly about Puerto Rico. I mean, one didn't have this impression. Like I said, that people around the world think of it as blessed because the US has taken it over, right? So you got to the nitty-gritty. You pointed that out.
You know, the thing is that the empire that they have is now economic in many ways, right? They literally control countries through their economic power. And that's how they have that. We don't need to necessarily invade any country in Latin America, our porch, our backyard, which is so arrogant. But, you know, it's, you know, we just pull the levers of the economy and maybe from time to time put a little bit of pressure on them, you know, and we can control them that way. And they maintain the hegemony, certainly in that hemisphere, right? So I think now you mentioned the name Laos. I think I might have heard of him. And, you know, I have a long wish list of books that I have to read. I think I probably have him somewhere in that list now that I think about it, because I think he won an award.
Yeah, I think the Romulo Gallegos, if I'm not mistaken, he won an award. And in the book, there's a discussion as well about with two characters. One is a Spaniard who's come to Puerto Rico and he's a visiting writer. And the principal protagonist tells him, he said, you people are not bothered about us. Spain just has a publishing industry. It does not have a literature today, right? And, you know, the anguish of being Puerto Rican and of being brilliant and of going unnoticed in the U.S., that's what the play is.
That's another thing, right? Here I am. I should be reading his work, too. But I had so much work from the diaspora writers that I need to write, because that's also, you know, along with a co-editor, we put together the only collection of critical essays on the literature of the Puerto Rican diaspora, because we found from our side that we weren't getting enough, you know, there's Hispanic department, Hispanic studies departments, you know, Spanish departments that actually do include Puerto Rican literature from the island. But then that leaves us, and then the American literary establishment doesn't quite do us, understand us. So there is not much work done. So we had to put something together, Carmen Aida Rivera and myself. And, you know, it's like a collection of 16 essays that deals with different aspects of the literature of the Puerto Rican diaspora. So there's a lot of work still to be done there. How that those two literatures get integrated is difficult, I understand. But because I know, when I was in the University of Puerto Rico, I actually put together a course on the literature from here. And when I went back, you know, to do a little book tour, and I visited Calle, the University of Puerto Rico Calle. You know, I was happy to find out that course is still there. So they're still teaching it over there. And also the main campus in Rio Piedras is teaching the literature of the island. And Spanish departments here sometimes do teach both, you know, diaspora literature. So, but it's very rare, very rare. So there's a gap there. There's a certain divide there that comes with being separated, right, from your homeland.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, most of your stories are written in the realist mode, but you also bring in fantasy via protagonists who indulge themselves through the internet and vaping. These are many ways of bringing credence to the narrative, and you seem to live vicariously through the characters at times. That's just my opinion. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think every writer will tell you that to a certain point we live vicariously by our characters, and to what extent, what is the vicarious, either pleasure or whatever that we get from creating characters that sometimes, you know, are distasteful to us. Or also people we're creating, people that really are terrible people. You know, I don't know what is that pleasure. It's maybe just trying to see, if not size of ourselves, size of other human beings that we find, fascinating. We're curious creatures, writers, and we like to delve into things. One of my favorite sayings is from Akira Kurosawa, who's a Japanese filmmaker. And it's something like, you know, to be an artist means to never avoid your gaze, right? Or to avert your eyes, meaning look at it, because look at things, even as ugly as they might be, because to be an artist, it means to deal with that. If it's something that you see and it haunts you in some way, then you maybe should write about it or create something, you know, in his case, films. And so my stories sometimes are not, I mean, if you come to my fictional world looking for escape, I'm not going to give it to you. Although the fantasy you talk about is a form of escape, right? If you're talking about In World, which is this older guy, actually middle age, who's lost his wife, and he now is alone. But the difference here, this is a story that's been told many times, right? Here's a widower. Okay, so what happens? But he's also Puerto Rican, as many of my characters are. And he's now someone who has completely broken off from his culture for various reasons. You know, his family seems to be crazy from his perspective. And he went, he always had a separation from them and from the whole Puerto Rican thing, right? And now he finds himself alone in a country, in a part of the country that's really very white. And now he must deal with his grief at the same time that he is alone, right? So he ends up entering this sort of, and this must be in the near future, right? Where I don't think this kind of technology, which can almost immerse yourself in this sort of virtual world. And he begins to submerge himself in that world to the point that he loses all reality. And it's sort of like what I think it was Bernard who said, you know, well, I keep thinking of certain things. One, the movie Blade Runner. I don't know if you're familiar with that film, which takes place in the future. And this it's sort of a world where they have these androids that are more real than real, right? So here what I'm dealing with is this idea of hyper-reality, right? That sometimes what is simulated, the simulacra, is much more real to people than the real life that they live. And that's also pointing to the dangers of this kind of thing, right? I think people really do escape any way they can from the pains and anguish of real life, and then to go into a virtual reality where everything they do to a certain point is controlled, and they can be whoever they want, is dangerous. And to deal with your dislocation from your culture and your people is a dangerous thing to me. It really is. And you see that also in the doctor in the operation, right? Because he really has never been connected to his Jewish, you know, he's not really Jewish by Jewish law and culture, because his mother wasn't Jewish. But he doesn't really, his father who was, did not really teach him about that. And then when he goes to Puerto Rico and they're performing all these operations, really horrific, sterilizing women, he's part of that. He doesn't realize, he doesn't even connect anything of his own, you know, history as his people anyway, or part of his people. And so I think once you dislocate from yourself and your culture, you're in a danger zone. That particular character, Melvin, happens to him. So I don't find vicarious pleasure in writing about that cat, but I what I'm looking at is a horror to me. You know, that what this is what happens, you know, when you just get so lost and you end up being submerged in this world, this fantasy, and it's not a good thing. And the vaping part of it is, by the way, there's connections to these characters sometimes. The next story, which I think is Runaway, is about a model in the near future too, when there's climate change has really taken an impact, which it will eventually, unless the world wakes up, and the U.S. in particular, who's the biggest polluter in the world. We don't do something about it. You know, some of the things that are happening in that story are going to happen. Puerto Rico, who knows, is going to be really submerged in water. I mean, it's very possible. The oceans are rising. We know that. And so in that story, she's living in that time period when being a little bit, you know, a little heavier is actually the model type, because women who are famished because the food supply is not really, as what it was. And you can see how that could happen, right? Because you will always, in the U.S., in capitalism, find a way to make money out of the worst situations. So if now women wish they were a little heavier because they're starving, a woman who happens to be curvy, as maybe Puerto Rican women are, just, you know, they happen to be a little curvier. It's true, I think, you know. And so so that becomes the model type. And they're forcing her to eat more. They don't want her to lose weight. And she's living in this world in Puerto Rico. She goes to Puerto Rico, just like you said. Puerto Rico to her still is this like paradise. Like the world is literally crumbling apart, falling apart. And she escapes to Puerto Rico as some kind of fantasy, right? But doesn't notice the rising water in the airport where they have to get the bags in a motorboat, you know. She doesn't, you know. And then on top of that, she's already trying to escape. And then she tries to escape by vaping and using hallucinatory drugs. And so that to me is the state of a lot of Puerto Ricans today, metaphorically. I mean, they're just so clueless to our situation and resigned to just staying the way we are and not doing anything about it, that it's almost like loopy in that story. So yeah, I don't know, again, to go back to your original question, I just feel like I try to enter situations that sometimes do make me feel uncomfortable, but I want to, because I think as a writer, I should do that. And it just seemed to me like a good story, you know, both of those. And I said, let me just go with it. And I know that might be controversial, but that's okay. I mean, I think, you know, again, I'm not a writer that tries to, and this is why I don't have a big readership. I just feel as if some of the stories do people read them and they, you know, they're not comfortable. And I'm not going to apologize to make you uncomfortable. Maybe in the discomfort, maybe you should think about why you feel uncomfortable. Or for instance, the story where the man gets transitioned, right? You mentioned early on, this is a typical sucio, using, again, going back to the idea that I like to tackle these stereotypical Latinx characters, you know, and that's one of them, created even by, and you know, one of our, you know, Latinx writers, Junot Diaz, which I've had problems. I have problems with some of his writings. I mean, dude, like, you keep writing about this type of man. And I feel that that's just, it's true to a certain point, but not every guy's like that. And every book you write is about these guys. So I just kind of took that and ran with it as a parody, almost making fun of it. And then it gets more serious, the story. That's a perfect example, Minnie, of how I start. And when I started out, I thought humor would be the way to do it, and then it was really horrible. Actually, I'm glad I never published that, because I realized that as I looked into more research into transgender people and transition people, it's nothing to laugh about. So it had to become a serious story, and then I was like, can I write this story? You know what I mean? Can I write this story? And I think I did a lot of research. I really tried to do it from a position of empathy and understanding, to create a guy that was accidentally, right? This is not a person that is transgender that says, I want to do this. I mean, he wanted to sort of change his ways as a machista guy, right? So, somebody tells him, if you go to this, you get therapy and a little bit of medicine to kind of help you. I don't know what that medicine would be, because there are drugs to kind of make desexualize you a little bit. You know, I guess he thinks he's too much of a sexual creature that he needs help, right? He can't do it by his own self. He needs something. So he goes to this clinic that's an underground, very kind of underground clinic, and they make a mistake. So now he's, you know, he is a woman, you know, physically, you know, but not really. So it's one of those great what if that happened, you know, that then I went with it. So that question is interesting about the vicarious. I think, again, getting back to my original question, we all, you know, writers, I think, do kind of like to play with different types of characters, even villains. Right, I think there is a pleasure by writing a villain that, you know, you're not like that person, but I mean, if you could be, sometimes villains, you know, get away with stuff, or they do things that maybe you wouldn't dare do, but they do. So there's something to that. I think it's part of the creative process and using your imagination. That's a long response, but it was such a fascinating question.
Your story, that was most effective, the one about El Sucio and the castration, etc., because it brought out the stereotypical idea of the macho man and the rest of it. And the other thing you're also fascinated with is getting into the minds of these rich people, rich Puerto Ricans who come to Puerto Rico. That was what I felt. What exactly are they thinking? What do they see? What do they look at Puerto Rico like? And most of the time, they're as ingenuous as any white North American who has never suffered and deracinated completely.
Right, because so even Nikki, I think, to a certain point, and that's me also working with my own conflicts, you know, as someone who comes from a working class background to becoming bourgeois, because, you know, you cannot go through the higher educational system in the U.S. without becoming middle class. I mean, that's the whole point, right? You go to college to become middle class, whatever your roots are. You know, you go to college, you get educated, you know, you're professional, now you're middle class. And, you know, so I of course, have bourgeois tendencies. And you have to be metacritical about these things, right, to a certain point. But I always think that I like to think and continue to think about my working class roots. You know, my mother worked in a factory. Her whole life she was in shrimp shots. My stepfather lost his fingers working, you know, as a superintendent of a you know, high-rise building in Manhattan, cleaning snow. And he made the mistake of trying to clean the snow from this thing, and he cut, you know, some of his fingers. And, you know, so it's you know, that is not easily erased from my memory and my history. So I try to, and I try to, when I write something about a middle-class person, I'm looking at myself and even questioning me myself, right? Because sometimes it's very easy to go, well, that's not my problem, but it is, you know? It's all our problems. And so Nikki is a good example. Actually, she goes to this resort to try to sell her husband's, you know, 52, Cadillac, and I've had people ask me, well, what's that with the Cadillac? This is always on the cover, right? It's on the cover. And I say, well, the 52 was a year that the Commonwealth government came into power. Estado Libre Asociado. That's my symbol, right? That car. And for the start of the story with that, she's trying to sell this because it's already old and it's sort of decrepit. But she thinks it's wonderful. She thinks it's, you know, this is an old car. It should be able to, you know, get a lot of money, right? And nobody really wants it. Nobody wants to buy from her, except that woman that might have had an affair with her husband. And so, you know, I'd like to think that I'm always looking at those kinds of issues, really, about that. And, you know, rich people, rich Puerto Ricans. In fact, I've had an idea to write a collection completely about middle-class Puerto Ricans. You know, whether they be in Puerto Rico or they are in the States. In the States, I think it's more interesting because Rosario Ferrer, who I'm sure you're probably aware of, she's a Puerto Rican writer. I think she writes both, actually. She used to write. She's passed. But she's written enough about, because she comes from a wealthy Puerto Rican family, and that I allude to, by the way, in Mint Condition. And it's very possible that woman that had the affair is sort of like somebody in the Ferrer family. But, you know, she's written about the upper class in Puerto Rico, which I call the elite colonial class. They're the status quo. They're the ones that really run the colonial government and nation or state or whatever it is, you know, neo-colony. And so they've made wealth still. And they have their own different ideas about what's going on, obviously, and they don't take any responsibility. I mean, if you look at it, if you look at her situation from a critical Marxist perspective, their class failed to become, to make the nation state, right? They have failed. And now they have resigned themselves to this colonial situation because it's the only way they can keep some power. So to the detriment of the rest of Puerto Rico. So that's an interesting study of those people and also, you know, the diasporicans who have made, you know, done better. People like me, you know, who are now middle class and upper middle class. What about them? What's our state of mind? What's life different? Edgardo Vega, by the way, Yunque also wrote about them. So there was already a territory there to start writing about that. And I think it will come with the mere fact that we just are entering into middle class.
Yeah, there's a lot of churning then in the literary world in Puerto Rico, right? Churning, you know, mixing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, because, you know, we're as mixed as you can get from everything. We're mixed, you know, racially. I mean, we're Caribbean people. And the Caribbean has always been about, you know, sort of mixture and melding and you know. And then a lot of us are writing in a post-colonial world, in postmodernist world, where, you know, mixing genres is the thing, right? So I enjoyed that a lot, actually. I really do enjoy it, and I do use that a lot. In this collection, there's a lot of that, I feel.
In the sense, what I meant, this churning was also, for example, in the World Republic of Letters, you know, now you don't have to be an elite person to be a writer. You don't have to have read a series of classics to become a writer.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think some of the best literature is coming out from people who have never got an MFA personally. And, you know, because that's the thing now, right? It's an MFA factory out there. And it's just, you know, you turn out that MFA and then you get your first book and again, it's whatever. And there's people who are actually writing from a position. And maybe that's why they're more fascinating because, like anything else, the MFA factory keeps producing similar, you know, similar poetry, similar stuff, you know. I think that that people who come from working class backgrounds, who come, you know, who never even went to college, are writing excellent, authentic, raw stuff that does what I think primarily literature should do, is move you in some way, you know, really make you feel something, and they do that. I would agree. Yeah.
Now, you've written a novel, then poetry, then short stories. What's your next project?
Yeah, I'm in fact the one of the stories in Migrations in this collection is about Roberto Clemente. It's called Clemente Burning, and that is the beginning of my next project. You know, I wanted to include it in here for various reasons. One, I wanted to include another story in there. And I thought it could stand on its own, you know, in the first part. And also, you know, if it got published, people will go, oh, this is interesting. And I can follow through with the novella coming. So I'm hoping to finish it by next year. And it's about him. But it's not just about, and I don't know if you, Minnie, or maybe some of you listeners know, Roberto Clemente is sort of an icon, a baseball icon. Baseball is supposedly our number one sport, but I think football is. But he is well-known. He was a Hall of Fame baseball player, but he was also Afro-Puerto Rican. And so I want to really delve into race and racism, you know, from a Caribbean Puerto Rican perspective. And kind of many times I always say that I write to answer questions for myself. And I want to really put race and blackness in the center of this query now, you know, like what's going on with us with race, because we're mixed people, but, you know, there's a lot of racism in Puerto Rico still, you know? And so we have a caste system to a certain point, you know, and, you know, closer to the whiteness, the better for you, you know? And that's almost necessary because, you know, everybody's mixed, right? So people feel like, well, it's not enough to just have one drop of African ancestry, because a lot of us have a lot or more than others, you know? So now it's a question how closer you are to that white ideal, that racist white ideal. And I think he's a good example because he's well known. He was definitely an Afro-Puerto Rican, and he also was dealing with that issue because he always saw himself as Puerto Rican, because the only model that he had was this black-white paradigm that he confronted in the U.S. Either you're black, meaning African-American, or you're white. And he just didn't see himself that way because he grew up in a Caribbean environment that dealt with race in a different way. So I want to explore that. And, you know, he's really at this point in the book early on, he's dead. This is after he has that tragic accident when he's taking help, humanitarian aid to Nicaragua for that earthquake in Managua in 1972, I want to say. Yeah, 1972, because next year is going to be 50 years. And his plane crashed and lost a great person, a great human being, a fantastic ball player, you know, Puerto Rican idol. And so what better figure than Roberto Clemente to kind of go on this journey with me to try to figure out race in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, that's a fascinating project. We've had books also cast by Isabel Wilkerson. You know, I think cast is a good way of describing this whole stratification because it's so apt. And she, yeah, and in your stories as well, you hinted that this closeness to the ideal of whiteness, which everyone strives for, to be white, to mantener la raza, to maintain.
Right.
Maintain.
Oh my God! You know your stuff. It's true. I mean, people really have told that to people, in Puerto Rico. You know, wow, it's mantener, mejorar. Mejorar, which is even improve the race. I mean, it's like improve because we're not good enough. You know, you need to get that whiteness to get better. It's shocking. You know,
so you get
that's
married to the right person.
Right.
We understand that very well.
Which is really interesting too, because, you know, if you look at Clemente and his wife was a little lighter skinned than him, you know? And so it's always a little bit of that, you know, and we have to just dismantle that whole thing. It's awful. Yeah.
Now, what's been the reception like of your work?
Well, I'm going to honestly, it's not much reception. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I just over here publishing is, you know, for instance, I know India has really had a wonderful explosion, really, I think. And I think it's because India really has a book literary culture. In Puerto Rico, we came into literacy just late in the 20th century, you know, and also we went right in from you know, in the 20th century right into television, you know, and all that. It was like we couldn't really had the time to grow a literary kind of world. Certainly, there was the elite that had that, but in terms of the masses, no, not so much. We don't have that many bookstores in Puerto Rico to this day. And in the Bronx, where there's a lot of Puerto Ricans, we got one bookstore in the Bronx, New York. One bookstore. It's insane. So, you know, my people, I don't know if they're reading my book. I really honestly. And people have told me, oh, you know, I've read your book. It's great. But, you know, I'm not getting any reviews. In fact, I don't think there's been one review. The only person who's reviewed my book just to give me an endorsement was Ixta Murray, who's a fantastic Chicano writer. And I really appreciate it. And the person who judged my book. You know, Luis Alberto Urrea is, but both of those people are Mexican Americans, you know, right? Like, I don't know where my Puerto Rican brethren are. I mean, I really don't. And because I also have sent the book to people and they have it, they got the collection, they haven't given me any feedback. So I don't really know. So
they're still thinking about it. I think they're still thinking about it and wondering what to say. Because, like I told you, the book impacted me quite a bit as well. It revealed a lot of truths, but maybe, you know, because for them it's so close to home, you know, so I understand how they might feel.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, especially with my colleagues in the academy, I think they obviously must ponder it, critically in a very different way than somebody just reviewing it for it. And, you know, so, and I've gotten a couple of Goodreads reviews, and, you know, I try not to look at Goodreads because I think some of those people just don't, I don't know, they don't know where I'm coming from. And I think there is a gap in what they say. It tells me, I don't think you read this, I mean, in the right light or something. They just don't, you know, they just don't get it. So, you know, you can't go by that either. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm waiting to see. Instead of 3 months, certainly this is not a book that was published by a big publisher. LARB Books does not have a big budget. They have a wonderful, publicist who's getting me these podcasts. And I, to their credit, I think I have more of an online presence I've ever had in my life, my career. That's great that they're doing that. But it's harder to get reviews. Generally, really, quite frankly, generally, I think the book review in the United States now, it's almost dead. It's very difficult unless you have really super good agent that has incredible connections that can go directly to the person in the New York Times. Read this, you know, and then your client is Colson Whitehead, you know? Who is going to turn down writing a review about Colson Whitehead? Because I would take that. I would take that in a heartbeat because you know your name up there is going to be automatically just by critiquing him because people are going to read it. So it's a, you know, it's very commercialized. It's a different tiered, economically tiered publishing world. And honestly, I don't write to make money. Never. I mean, after a while, I said, I'm not going to make money from this. And I'm retired. I just want to write honest books. I want to write stories that I feel, you know, set a record too, right? Because maybe even if I'm gone, there's always interesting how sometimes future generations get intrigued and follow a thread of researching, you know, find a book. That's happened even in Chicano literature, you know, with the Don and the squatter, Maria de Burton, right? Who was unknown. And now that book is in the Norton Anthology of Literature. So you want to write a record and just write because you feel you have to write. There's an urgency there. And down the line, maybe other people will read it and pick it up and go, wow, this guy was writing about this stuff. And that's all I can hope for right now. I mean,
yeah. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, Jose Luis. And I hope your books are very successful. I, for one, will definitely teach some of your stories in my class because they've read Eduardo Lalo, so they can relate. I think also readers of Latin American literature would relate better to your stories. They would. Maybe the rest of Latin America, your book will work if it's translated into Spanish. We have the problem.
Yeah,
there
I wish I could. And I'm not, you know, I'm fluent with that, but I'm not, you know, I'm not. First of all, trying to translate my own work into Spanish, I couldn't. If I can just find a good translator, I would do it. If I could even pay for it, I would do it because I think it would get a better goal. But you're right. I think that it's more like, because, you know, you mentioned Latin America. You know, I majored in college. One of my majors was Hispanic studies. And I gravitated immediately to Latin American literature. I just fell in love with American literature. And I think there's some influences still. Borges was... to me, a great master of the short story, the boom, because I grew up with the boom, that, you know, the Latin American boom, and all those writers were Cortázar. I mean, they were fabulous writers, and I still love them, Fuentes, and and they influenced me a lot. So I think, yeah, you're right. Probably I still kind of write more towards that than American.
Okay, thank you very much, Jose Luis. Thank you so much for talking to us and telling us about your book.
Thank you. I hope that your listeners enjoy it. And thank you again for inviting me. It was a pleasurable conversation. The most intellectual one I've had, frankly, which I appreciate.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And I hope your students, if you do assign it to them, you know, and they just tell them if they want to in any way, contact me. You know, I don't know if you have my email, if you want, but send it to them. And I'm online. And I would love to hear what they have to say. I really would appreciate, especially somewhere from some other part of the world, letting me know what they think.
Thank you very much.